Welcome back to Mormon Expression Voices. We're excited today because we have with us Lance, who, from what I understand, has a really interesting missionary story for us. So welcome, Lance, and thanks for taking time out for us.
Thank you.
So I usually think it's good to have a bit of a background. If you want to give us a little bit about where you grew up and what your family's history is in Mormonism.
I was born in Wyoming. I grew up the first half of my life in Utah, in Payson. And then when I was a teenager, we moved to Florida. And I lived there. I went on a mission from Florida and returned to Florida. And then after my mission, I moved back to Utah. That was in 97. And I've lived here in Tooele County pretty much ever since. Yeah, my mom is, I don't know how many generations of Mormon she comes from. My dad was a convert when he married my mom. And of course I was born and raised in the church. So I think that sums up my story, or my life, I guess. It's a pretty good summary.
So you grew up Mormon, and do you want to just lead into your mission or leading up to your mission?
Yeah, I grew up Mormon. I was a pretty good kid. I never did anything really bad. You know, bad according to Mormon doctrine. I was a pretty good Mormon boy.
And what did you like, young men's and scouts? Was that good for you growing up?
I hated scouts. I wasn't an outdoorsy type of kid. I preferred indoors. I wasn't into competitive sports. You know, I didn't fit that mold, I guess. All of my friends pretty much growing up were Mormon. Even in Florida, my only close friends were Mormon. I had a hard time moving from Utah to Florida. I had a hard time, interacting with non-Mormons. I didn't quite fit in. So all of my friends were, LDS. And so I liked young men's, I guess. I went to church. In fact, when I was younger, I would go to my friend's house. He didn't really want to go to church, and I'd take him to church with me so we could hang out at church. So that's about how I was there, I think.
Okay. And did you get an Eagle Scout?
No, I didn't. I think I got a star or something, and then I stopped with scouting. I got tired of it.
And your parents didn't push you to do it?
No, so the scout leader, and this is kind of a segue story, I know. The scout leader, when I was around that age, I think I was 12 or 13 when I really kind of stopped going. My older brother, I must have been 12. My older brother was 16 or 17. And the scout leader was, of our ward, the scout leader was molesting his children, I guess. And at the time it was being kind of covered up by the stake president and the bishop. And my dad found out about it and really kind of went off on him. This would be in the 80s, mid 80s, I think, got him removed. And that's kind of when scouting kind of became optional for us, I think.
Wow, I would think so.
Strange is I don't remember any criminal, you know, I was kind of kept out of that. I don't know the whole story, but, you know, I don't recall any criminal charges or anything. I don't know if it was covered up with what, but.
So you don't know if the stake president and bishop were hiding it from the law as well?
Right, I don't know. I know my dad found out about it from what I understand and confronted the stake president and bishop and said, look, I've heard that this guy was accused, and he was accused by one of his daughters. I guess his oldest daughter went to the police or went to the stake president or the bishop or somebody. And this is in a small Utah town in Payson, so I think they were all kind of related, the authorities were, and made the allegations because her little sister was reaching puberty, as I understand it, and he was starting to be attracted to her too. And so she went and told on him because she didn't want her sister to be molested, and that's when it all kind of came out. And my dad heard about it and went and confronted the bishop. And I guess the bishop and stake president had known about it some months in advance and had left the guy as a scout leader over the several months, and that didn't sit right with my dad. And so after that, I guess he was removed and they replaced him, but then we never had any pressure to go to scouts after that. So
kudos to your dad for standing up. That's awful.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a good guy for sure.
Okay. So that was your teenage years. What about, not specifically scouts, but in young men's, did you feel like you had a place there?
Yeah, I got into young men's mostly when I was in Florida, and it was a small, there were only, you know, three or four other guys there, and so it was a pretty small group, and I fit in pretty well there. And, you know, I have had good friends and would hang out after church and would do things together. And you know, I had a solid group of friends that I hung out with there, and you know, I still keep in contact with them today to some level. They live in various parts of the world now, so.
And did you always have the desire to go on a mission?
I kind of did, but when I was in high school, I got really into, I've always enjoyed knowledge and studying and learning. I wasn't a great student. I didn't like the busy work, so my grades were never super good, but I always liked learning and understanding. And so in high school, my junior year, I was accepted into, I took a test. One of them was the ASVAB test, this military test. And the other one was a specific Navy test that was for nuclear physics. And I was in an advanced physics class my junior year. And so I went and took those tests, and I scored really well on those. And so the Navy recruited me, or wanted to recruit me, my junior year to go into the nuclear power program that they have. And I really wanted to do that. And so I signed up, the idiot 17-year-old that I am. I'm like, yeah, that sounds cool. I could be on a carrier working with nuclear reactors. That's, you know, it's just up my alley there. So the recruiters brought all the forms in, and I was filling them out and signing them. And then they checked my birthday and said, wait a minute, you're only 17. Are you a senior or a junior? I said, no, I'm a junior. They said, oh, well, we'll come back next year and talk to you then. We can't take this. I said, okay. What's that?
Oh, I was going to ask if your parents knew you were doing all of that.
No, they had no idea. That's the, that's the beauty of my adolescent brain at the time. They had no idea. But then I told them about it, and they were okay with it. And so my senior year, they came back, and they called me up again towards the end of my senior year. And I signed up, and I was all ready to enlist. And I went in to get my physical done, and I failed my physical. I had a broken orbital. And they said to come back in 6 months, and they'd let me in. And I just graduated high school. And I kind of took that as a sign. There was some pressure. Well, you should probably go on a mission. I didn't want to, I didn't really want to. I was okay either way, but I kind of took that as a sign that, okay, maybe, you know, God wants me to go on a mission, so maybe I should. And so I did. I went on a mission. It wasn't my first choice, but you know, I did it.
Were you getting pressure from your family or friends or anyone to go on a mission?
Yeah, of course. Of course, I was getting pressure.
I wondered what you think of the earlier mission age now, being so young that a lot of men are leaving for their missions right out of high school. They even get their mission call while they're still in high school. What do you think of that?
I think it's incredibly bad. it might be bad for the missionaries, probably good for the church. I think, you know, I think that 1 year they lose a lot of potential missionaries, because, like in my case, had it been 18, I probably would have gone when I was 18, right after high school. But, you know, having it at 19, had I got into the Navy, I obviously wouldn't have gone. And so, you know, that 1 year, I think they've lost a lot of potential missionaries. And so, yeah, I think it's bad for the missionaries, because from my experience, even at 19 to 21, you know, you're ill-equipped to deal with the pressures that they put on the missionaries and the abuse that they lay on the missionaries. And so missionaries either crack under the pressure, which was kind of what happened to me, or they get deeper into the church, which is, I think, the goal of it, is to get these missionaries as pure, converts to where they'll have no chance of ever escaping. So I think in that regard, it's probably a good idea for the church to do it. I don't think it's in the best interest of the missionaries.
Right. It's easier to keep missionaries if they're leaving right from their mother's home rather than giving them a little life experience and kind of give them time to learn what they want for themselves.
That's my opinion, for sure.
And what do you mean by, you said abuse on the missionaries? What were you referring to?
Well, we'll probably get into that when I start telling my story in more detail. But the church treats missionaries terribly, right? Here they've got this salesperson who, if doing their job well, stands to make huge gains for the organization. All right, you've got if you kind of look at other traveling sales troops that you'll see around, these guys that go around selling security systems or DirecTV subscriptions or whatever door to door. You know, they're first of all they're paid. They likely receive some sorts of benefits. They're taken care of as employees, you know, whatever that means. But in the end, they make just a tiny bit for the organization. You know, I sell a DirecTV subscription. That's $80 a month or whatever. If I sell a Mormon subscription, you know, that's thousands of dollars for a long time. The church has no skin in that game. They don't pay for the missionaries. The missionaries are all self-funded. And then we'll get into this more in my story. I think for the most part, you know, they don't provide adequate accommodations for the missionaries. You know, sending a missionary to a third world country, I would expect the organization would put the missionaries up in accommodations that are comparable to where they came from. You know, a house with running water. They should have access to adequate health care, but they don't. They're not given proper training to take advantage of healthcare. And in my situation, I was in Japan. I had no idea that we could even go to the hospital. In fact, one time I got food poisoning and I was laying in bed throwing up for 2 days, not knowing what to do until a member came and said, "Hey, you need to go to the hospital." And I had no idea that that was even an option. And I was in a first world country. So it's those kinds of things, I think, that the church, at least when I was there, that they really were lacking in. You know, there was no training that said, okay, you know, if you get sick, call this number. Here's your ombudsman that's going to take care of managing the paperwork for you. Just go get better. You know, it was, and here's where your apartment is, and here's the forms you need to fill out for new converts and new investigators. Go nuts type of thing.
And also, if as an alarm salesman or DirecTV or whatever, you can leave at any time without any social repercussions. Mm-hmm. As a missionary, you have to get permission to leave, and then you have to face everyone back home.
Right, exactly. And also, as a missionary, and this is one thing, since getting off my mission, I actually started working for, I've worked on a number of government projects, and I've worked for companies that deal with military contracts and that sort of thing. And in all of them, you've got to take training on various topics. And one of the topics is human trafficking. And it's interesting, as I went through the human trafficking training, what kept going through my mind was, oh my God, that's a missionary. So signs that you're supposed to look for in dealing with human trafficking are, somebody goes to a foreign country or somebody's brought to a foreign country, and the organization that brought them or the person that brought them there immediately takes away their passport and stores it for quote unquote safekeeping, right? That's what the church does to missionaries. The church or the organization denies contact with family and friends back home or severely limits contact with family and friends back home. Again, that's the church. Let's see, I'm going from memory here, but the church or the organization that's conducting human trafficking will severely limit access to funding. You're not allowed to have your own bank account. Your bank account is controlled by the organization. The organization puts bare minimum into the bank account. Again, that's missionary. The organization limits travel of the person. You can't go outside of certain bounds. You have to be, there's a curfew imposed. You typically, in a lot of cases, you'll have a someone who's over you, you know, who's constantly watching and verifying that you're not going outside or doing things that you shouldn't be doing. And again, that's the church. And so as I've gone through that, I was like, yeah, they really do a lot of inhumane things to missionaries under the guise of, you know, this is the rules and it's to protect you. But the truth is, I think none of it does protect the missionaries, and any protection that's gained from that is far outweighed by the emotional and mental damage that's done by that.
I've never heard missions compared to human trafficking. As you went through those signs, I just got a pit in my stomach. Just never looked at it that way before. It's very disturbing.
It really is.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. You get your mission call, and you said it was to Japan. What part of Japan?
Let's back up a little farther than that.
Okay.
I had a good friend in, and this is kind of a funny segue, good friend in high school who he and I wanted to kind of go to the same place, and we wanted to go on a mission together. And, you know, that would be cool if we went to the same mission and we can hang out. We could, you know, and have that. And so we filled in our papers at the same time, and we were talking on the phone, as I recall, and comparing answers. What did you put for this? What did you put for that? And did all that stuff. And we were going to send them in at the same time. And I had a bit of a scheduling conflict with my interview with the state president. And so he actually went ahead and sent his in. And I was going to wait. And after I got my interview with the state president, then I was going to have to send mine in. And his came back like within the week. I was shocked. I thought it'd take a month or so to come back. It came back like within just a few days. And he had called me up and he'd got sent to Pocatello, Idaho. And so I tore up my mission papers. And I filled out a new set with a different, changed my answers a little bit so I wouldn't go to Pocatello, Idaho, and send it in again. And yeah, so then I got my mission call to Japan, and I went to Kobe, Japan.
What year was this?
This was in 94. So I went to the MTC in October. I believe it was October 26, 1994, that I actually went to the MTC. So I got into the MTC, went through that whole business. That's a stressful place for sure. They do a very good job with the indoctrination, and they're very good at that. When I went, the focus was less on language. We spent, you know, maybe a couple hours a day learning Japanese, and then much more time learning sales methodologies. You know, now I call them sales methodologies. Back then it was learning gospel principles, but we learned what they called the commitment pattern. We learned building relationships of trust, which never sat with me right. That business, even early on, I thought there was something skewed about that. We learned how to kind of manipulate feelings, and we did lots of exercises on this where we would have to listen for the investigators to say, you know, certain words or have certain emotional signs. And at that point, we were supposed to say the follow-up, which would elicit a emotional response. And then, bam, we got him type of a thing. I was never very good at that.
Well, they must not have called it manipulate feelings. Do you remember what they referred to it as?
It was all part of the commitment pattern.
Okay.
It was making commitments. Right. And in order to make commitments, you had to, and I forget what they call it, you know, they'd batter it with feelings of the spirit and blah, 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 blah. But it was all about making commitments and watching for signs that the person was ready to make a commitment and then make the appropriate commitment for the level that the person was at. So, you know, a new investigator, maybe the commitment was just to call you back, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe the commitment was, you know, just to read a paragraph on a piece of paper right there while you're with them in the street. Any commitment that you could solicit out of them gave you kind of a foothold. And then you could lead to further commitments and further commitments. And part of being able to establish or to make these commitments was to establish a relationship of trust with the other party. And even then, it always struck me as manipulation. I never really felt comfortable with it, doing it. And so, and I never did it well because I always gave the person an out. you know, that always use the will you pattern. Will you do this? Not would you please do this, or would you mind doing this, or how do you feel about doing this? It was will you, you know, how do you feel about X? I feel okay about X. Well, will you do Y? Right? So the commitment is the why. The commitment is the will you. And the feeling is the X. How do you feel about your family? Well, I love my family. Okay, well, will you call me back? Well, obviously I love my family. Therefore, yes, I will call you back. What does it say about me if I don't call you back? Well, I don't love my family type. And so it was that type of manipulation that you learned. And you learned it very, very effectively, I think. Even me, where I was kind of felt awkward about it and never probably did it well, I learned it very well. And even today, I find myself catching myself so that I'm not doing that to other people. So I'm not manipulating other people. I've kind of made myself a bit more passive than I probably should.
And then in the MTC, how was it physically? Because you go from having freedom to you're starting to be told when to go to bed, wake up, all that. How was that for you?
Yeah, that was hard for me. The food they feed you, it's very high calorie. It's all comfort food. So it's, I don't know if they do this because of an ulterior reason or if they just do it because it's cheap food. But you know, it's carb overload. It's crashing, you know, 2-3 hours after lunch. And so you're just mentally and physically exhausted by the end of the day. Essentially, even though you've not done anything, it's a lot of sitting, a lot of mental repetition. You know, it is waking up at a certain time, following a prescribed schedule for you. You do this at this time, you do this at this time, you do this at this time. That lasted for maybe 2 days for me. And I quickly realized that I didn't like taking cold showers with a bunch of naked dudes in the morning.
It took you 2 days to learn that, huh?
Yeah, I learned that on day one. It took me a couple days to learn that I actually had some power there. And so I ended up showering later at night while everybody else was doing their evening study. I'd go take a shower, hot water, come back, go to bed and do my studying in the morning, which worked out better for me anyway, because I'm more of a morning person. Yeah, so there was that. There were ways around some of those lesser issues. Or some of the lesser requirements, like when you study. As long as you studied, it was pretty much okay. I didn't get any kickback from that. One big one was attending the temple every week on P day. You had to, you know, you'd hurry up and do your laundry and you had to attend the temple, which was across the street. And
we should probably talk about what your first time was like going to the temple. What did you think of that first trip?
Let's see. So the first trip, so I went to the Orlando temple. I don't remember much about it. I think most of my energy was focused when I got the little bag, you know, the clothes bag. The first thing was, you know, I had to pay $3 for that, and I didn't have $3. I was poor. I was like, what, $3? What is this? And so my dad grabbed his wallet and paid him $3, as I recall, and I thought that was weird because we were in the temple changing money. And they had the cash registered there, and they're basically renting me clothes that I thought I'd already probably paid for because I'd given them 10% of my money anyway. That was weird. The weirdest thing was when they did the, oh God, hear the words of my mouth part, and stood in a circle and raised the hands up and did that. That really kind of, that, you know, all the other stuff was kind of weird. I was after the whole penalty stuff, but that bit really kind of freaked me out because, you know, that's shit that pagans do, right? And I've never heard that before. I recall that creeping me out. The movie, I was spending most of my time, you know, trying, hoping that the camera would pan down slightly on Eve. it was the brunette Eve, and I was 19, so what could I do? But yeah, it was a little creepy. I went once before my mission, and I didn't want to go again on my mission in Orlando. When I came out to the MTC, my aunt took me to the Salt Lake Temple where they have the live actors.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little, I don't know, that was a little comical. The actors weren't very good. and they kind of bumbled the park a little bit, and they were kind of old people, and I was like, eh, whatever. But the architecture in there was nice, and I kind of looked at that. I didn't put a lot of thought into it at that point. I think it wasn't until at the MTC where I'd go, you know, every week, where I had to go every week, that I kind of memorized the movie, and it kind of started freaking me out a little bit. So,
what was freaking you out about it?
You know, let me see if I can, well, I want to be careful that I'm giving you my memories of the time and not what freaks me out about it now.
Okay.
And so at the time, I think it centered around the true order of prayer. That was one of the freakiest things because, and this stuck with me from the movie. I know this was at the time because I'm fairly certain. Who knows how my memories are now, but the whole business of Adam praying at the altar and then Satan showing up, that was kind of unsettling to me. You know, that was like, wait, if Adam's praying at the altar and he's following the true order of prayer as learned in the temple, why would Satan show up? And, you know, in my current view, it's like, oh, well, because it's all bullshit anyway. My view at the time was, I think, if that can happen, then how can I trust myself, right? How will I know my feelings, right? If I'm praying and I'm getting answers from Satan, how would I know? Adam didn't know, and he'd seen God before, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a freaky thing. Nowadays, after going through this exit process and looking at it critically, there's many, many things that are creepier about it than that. And I think that was the one thing that was the creep. But, you know, you get over it, right? You put on a shelf and move on, which I did.
Well, that part, it concerned me because they also teach you how to rebuke Satan if you're ever confronted with him. And I couldn't remember what you were supposed to do. And that scared me because I'm like, great, Satan's going to come to me and I'm not going to know how to rebuke him.
Right. Yep. I think okay. That's a concern we all share. That's a big one there. Oh, but another thing about it was, and this is, you know, in my current line of thinking, the whole, ceiling thing. So a lot of the missionaries in my district, we had two sister missionaries and I think six or eight elders. Let's see, eight elders, two sisters and eight elders, including myself. And the sister missionaries and a couple of the elders would always go on the temple day and do ceilings. They love to do ceilings. And I'd never done a ceiling before, and I never wanted to, because that was something that I thought, you know, that's something I'm going to share with my wife. I don't want to pretend or do it by proxy for somebody else before I've shared that with my wife. And so I never went and did the ceilings. I only ever did the endowments during the time there. Even though the rest of the district liked to go and do the ceilings, I'd always, you know, turn that down and split with somebody else if my companion wanted to do the ceilings, because it felt, you know, it felt a little immoral. It felt like I was cheating on my future wife, right? I'm getting married to somebody else. And that was something that kind of freaked me out. I was like, oh, that's, you know, you don't have sex before marriage. Do you get married before marriage, type of thing? And so those were all concerns I had.
What did you think of, oh, now I'm going to forget what it's called, with the oil, the anointing?
Oh, the anointing?
Yeah. What did you think of that experience?
That I didn't like being naked. I didn't like the touching on the thigh. That was uncomfortable to me, especially the old guy with Parkinson's disease that was shaking. I only did that the one time for myself. I never did that again. That was a bit unsettling for me. Again, the district, a lot of times, you know, they'd pair off and they'd go to ceilings. And sometimes I recall one time they came back and had spent the day, doing anointings, and they were all really excited because their hair was super oily, because they'd get the oil dripped on them over and over and over again, and they were, you know, spiking their hair up and doing whatever with the oil after coming back having done the anointings all day. And that would have freaked me out. I don't think I could have handled that much physical touching. I was never much of a toucher or a hugger. even at that time, and so that was a little unsettling too.
All right, so you're on your mission, and you're getting sealed to other missionaries.
I was. But do you want me to start into my missionary story now?
Unless there's anything else you want to say about the MTC.
No, it was interesting, and it's set up. You heard a lot when you hear talks given at the little conferences that have, or at the branch meetings and district meetings that have. You'd hear a lot about companions, right? That was a theme. Stay with your companion. Your companion's there to protect you. Your companion is good practice for when you get married, because how you treat your companion and the thoughts that you have about your companion, positive and negative, are the same thoughts you're going to have about your wife. You know, if you can't stick with a companion 24 hours a day, well, how are you going to stick with a wife 24 hours a day? Because marriage is analogous to mission companion was an overarching theme there. Thank God it hasn't proved to be correct, because if that were true, I would probably not be married to this day.
All right, so you make it to Japan.
Okay, so I make it to Japan and landed in Tokyo, and then we transferred to the Kansai airport. It was a long flight. It was like a 15-hour flight, I want to say. Exhausted. We get there, and the mission president picks us up, and he and his wife picked us up along with the APs, and they had a van and a car, and I rode with the mission president and his wife back with another missionary. And my personality, even at the time, was such that I was chatty and jokey and kind of a fun guy. You know, I kind of enjoyed talking to people and everything. And so I did. And the mission president was President Wilson was his name. I think he passed away since my mission. He was a great guy. I really liked him, I think. And he and his wife were just amazing. Talked to him and all. And we get to the mission home and get set up for bed, and we slept on the floor there in the living room. And, the next day we were going to get our mission locations, where we were going to go and who our new companions were going to be. And I think the companions were already chosen, and where we were going to go was already chosen, but who was going to the individual areas was not yet chosen. Didn't choose that yet. So we go to bed. Next morning we wake up. I don't know that I could ever forget this. It was the first time I ever have had Eggs Benedict. And the mission president's wife had made Eggs Benedict, and they were fantastic. And so the first day was, you know, we had breakfast. They were going to tell us where we were going, as I recall. And then we were going to have a day's worth of training. You know, we talked to the APs, get shown around Japan a little bit. We got to go to a little restaurant and, you know, whatever, just kind of get acclimated a bit, maybe get a little over jet lag. The following day was when our companions were going to come in and we'd go to our new areas. So they gave out the assignments, and I got sent to Toyoka, which was a small little kind of rural town in the north, near the North Sea, near the Sea of Japan, just north of Kobe on the other side of the main island there. As luck would have it, one of the APs, that was his first area. And so he came over and talked to me, congratulated me on going to Toyoka. Great place. He had a tremendous success there. Apparently the ward there had 125, 150 members. And I guess he had baptized a number of members, 20 or so people. I can't remember what the number was, but a huge number of people were baptized in that area by this AP. And AP, for those who don't know, is assistant to the president assistant to the president. It's a missionary position. A missionary position. It's a position in your mission that, you know, it's kind of what all good missionaries aspire to be. You know, if you're the AP, then you are the cream of the crop, right? You've done a successful mission type of thing. And so it carries a lot of weight. And he talked to me for a while and how excited he was. And he was throwing out names as if I could even remember. I don't remember names in English. I couldn't remember names in Japanese. My goodness. But so he was pretty excited that I was going over there. It'd be really great. And then the mission president pulled me aside and said, Lance, you know, I'm I'm really excited that you're going up. Your companion's from Louisiana. And where you're from, Florida, I think you'll get along just great for some reason. I think, you know, your personalities will match up. You'll have a great time up there. Good luck. Okay, great. And fantastic. So the following day, I meet my mission companion and we hang out for a little bit and then we hop on a train and start heading up to our area. And I'm really excited. I couldn't wait. I'm all pumped up, ready to teach the gospel. And, you know, I'm envisioning we're going to have a baptism every Saturday or two. You know, we'll be spending a lot of time in the water, you know, it's going to be great. And we got to our area. It was probably around 10 or 11 at night. It was quite a long train ride to get there. And so we get into apartment and I get settled and go to sleep and wake up the next morning at like 10:30 in the morning. You know, I'm freaking out because you get up at 6:30 or 7, I can't remember. And first day there and I already broke the rule. And so I was freaking out a little bit and my companion was still asleep too. And so I was like, oh, okay, well maybe it's not such a big deal. So then the next day, I want to say this was a Saturday that my first full day there was a Saturday. And so my companion was going to take me and show me around, introduce me to some members. You know, they had a little party that night where I got to eat sushi for the first time, met a few of the members and we kind of hung out and, you know, I couldn't understand anything anybody was saying. They were chattering along. The next day was church, I think. And I think it was the next day. And I realized when I woke up on Sunday that we'd not been to the church and I didn't see the ward house. And I was like, whoa, you know, didn't know where the church was. And I asked my commander, I said, where's the church? He said, oh, it's just across the street. I said, what? Across the street? Doesn't make sense. I didn't see any buildings that could accommodate a ward, you know, coming from a place where the ward houses were these huge buildings with tons of classrooms. But we get up the next morning, we go to church, and sure enough, it's right across the street, and it's a house. It's a house that has, it's a two-floor house. The first floor had a kitchen and a small kind of living room. The second floor was just basically one room with the Japanese sectional doors that you see removed, so it was just kind of one large room. Not very big, had maybe 20 folding chairs set up pointing towards a small pulpit at the front of the upstairs room there. Thought, well, what the heck is going on here? How are they going to fit 150 people in here? No way. But that day, I think 8 people showed up, including the 4 missionaries that were there, myself, my companion, and the 2. So maybe 4 or 6 people who weren't missionaries actually showed up that day.
And so were you wondering where the 150 members were?
I was wondering where everybody was. You know, I mean, this one missionary just a year and a half earlier had baptized, you know, any number of missionaries. I can't remember what the number was, but it was in the 20s or 30s, I think, from what I recall. And I was wondering where everybody was, what's going on. And so we did the sacrament meeting, and I couldn't understand anything. I couldn't understand except for what my companion was telling me. And learning later, frankly, I don't think he could understand anything either. I don't think his Japanese was very good. But after the meeting, we were going to go and visit some other members and take them and administer the sacrament to them. And so we hopped in the car with a couple missionary, with the senior missionaries. They were in their 70s and had a car. And so that was a nice area because we got rides every now and then. And we went to this apartment complex where there were a number of members that received the sacrament or that they needed to take the sacrament to, and they'd go every Sunday, I guess, or whatever. And we go into this big apartment complex and all the buildings kind of look the same to me there. They were kind of 1950s style Japanese building. And we go in and I was expecting some elevator, you know, an apartment looking thing, but there's a desk there. There's a front desk there and there's a nurse sitting behind the desk. And I was like, what the heck? And I look down the hall and some guy walks across, I'll never forget this, he walks across in like a dressing gown type looking thing with pink fuzzy slippers on. And he was drooling on himself, you know, he's drooling. And I realized we were at a mental hospital. And what had happened, and I asked my companion about this, and he gave me the story, what had happened is this AP and his companion had been going to this mental hospital and signing mental patients up to get baptized, and he was baptizing them apparently in the physical therapy pool in the downstairs of this mental hospital. So a large number of the members on record were in this mental hospital.
Get out.
I'm serious. And the primary investigators that this couple missionaries had were also from this mental hospital. So I guess they'd been there during the heyday of these baptisms happening, and they still had some trailing investigators that they were trying to get baptized. And one of their investigators that I met that actually did get baptized, I remember waking up one morning and getting a call from this sister missionary. She was so excited. We had to hurry up and go meet with this guy and get him. My companion was the district leader and had to get the interview with the district leader because he'd just gotten out of the hospital. And before his mom could get a hold of him and recommitted, they wanted to hurry up and get him baptized. And so we did. We went and my companion interviewed him and okayed it, I guess. And they baptized him. And, you know, going through this process of baptism is pretty exciting for the person getting baptized, you know. All eyes are on you. It's a very special thing. You feel good about yourself. It's great. Everybody's positive. And so he got baptized and they had the little ceremony there. After the baptism, he gave his little testimony thing. And then kind of as they were cleaning up, my companion and I had a job or an appointment to get to. So we left the church and we're heading out and we ran into him in kind of a street behind the church there. And he was smoking a cigarette. So he left his baptism, went back and started smoking a cigarette. The sad thing about it was he knew it was wrong and he knew we wouldn't approve of it. And so when he saw us, he quickly stamped out his cigarette and swished the air away, you know, swished the smoke away so we wouldn't notice. And the poor guy, he was mentally retarded, basically. And here the church is putting this type of pressure on him. And I think he was ill-equipped to deal with it. And he ended up back in the hospital anyway, which was probably for the best for him.
In the missionary questions, for baptism, they need to add, are you of sound mind and can make your own decisions?
Maybe. I never actually interviewed anybody for baptism, so I don't know what those questions are. So anyway, so that happened. That was kind of a, you know, that was a little blow to my faith there.
Were you thinking when you realized that all these baptisms were coming from a mental hospital? Did you put that on the shelf or did you try to reason it in your mind?
I didn't try to reason it. I think I put it on my shelf and I think what I thought was I could do better. You know, I can do better than this. And we never went back to that mental hospital. At least I never did. I don't know if missionaries after us went or not. Who knows? But I told my companion, I said, we're not going back there. It's gross. It's uncomfortable. It smells funny. We're not doing those people any good. Right? Most of them, the ones we met with that day, they seemed like they didn't even know who we were. They're like, what? Oh, is this medicine I'm taking? Yeah, you know, it's just the bread's just another pill they're supposed to. They were completely oblivious to anything that was going on, I think. And so,
Do you know if the missionary president knew of these baptisms?
I don't know if he did or not. I am sure he knew of the baptisms. I don't know if he knew of the circumstances behind them or what. Anyway, moving on a bit on that same area, and this is something that, you know, I do know the mission in that same area. So I wake up one morning pretty early. It must have been 1 or 2 o'clock to use the restroom and my companion's gone. This is the first senior companion that I have on my mission and he's just gone. And I look down I look around the house, he's gone. He's not anywhere to be found. And, you know, that's freaking me out. I'm all alone. Who knows what's going on with this guy? He's my responsibility. I'm a failure. You know, you're responsible for that stuff. And I kind of look outside. I don't see him anywhere. Kind of freaking out, but what can I do? So I ended up going back to sleep and he was back in the morning. I didn't confront him about it. I didn't ask him about it, really.
Did he know you knew he was gone?
No, he didn't know I knew he was gone, and I didn't say anything to him. This went on for a bit, a few nights, I think. I'd wake up and see that he was gone, and so finally one night I was like, okay, I need to find out what's going on here. So I staged a caper, I guess. I faked going to sleep, and I waited until he got up, and sure enough, he got up and he got dressed, and I followed him. You know, he left the apartment. I followed him. It was dark and going down these streets, and he didn't know I was following him. He didn't take any action to lose me or anything. But he goes maybe, you know, 10 or 12 blocks, I can't remember. And then he goes into a snack, they called them. They're basically these kind of bar club places, they're kind of bars. He goes into this bar, and he's like, oh, hell, what is going on here? I can't go into this bar. And as luck would have it, it was a day or two before for the conference at the mission home. And so it's like, okay, I need to tell the mission president about this. I don't know what to do. And I didn't confront him with it. I didn't ask him about it. But we went to this mission conference, and I asked the mission I had an interview with the mission president. I said, you know, President Wilson, my companion he's sneaking out at night, and he's been going to this bar. And I was pretty scared and didn't know what was going on. And you know, and I don't know what to do about it. And he said, well, he said, I know. What? He said, yeah, I know. He has a part-time job tending bar. I said, what? A part-time job tending bar? And he said, yeah, his family is really, really anti-Mormon. And when he came on his mission, they cut off all support for him. And so he's having a really hard time. And so, you know, I've been overlooking this because it helps him, you know, get a little extra money. And as long as he's not drinking and as long as he's not, you know, committing any sins, then, you know, we just kind of want to let it go. We don't want to, I don't want to send him home. You know, and it's really hard. So, you know, just kind of do the best you can. And, you know, to his credit, I think that was a good thing to do. That my companion, I think he had a really rough time. And he's since, as I understand it, had a really rough time. And he's a great guy, my companion. I wish I kept in touch with him more, but I didn't. But he was a really good guy, I think. And so, you know, so that was my first area. So I had a companion who tended bar as a part-time job in an area that most of the members were committed to a mental institution.
I'm just wondering why the church didn't pay his expenses. I mean, they are wealthy enough to cover a missionary's costs.
I don't know. I don't know if maybe they were, and he just needed a little extra or wanted a little extra or something. I don't know. You know, who knows? Well,
my mind is blown.
Yeah, he got transferred. I was in that area, I want to say, for 8 months. And that was, I stayed in areas for a long time on my mission. I went through him and another companion in that same area. I think I only had the two companions. I was with him for about 5 or 6 months and the next one for about 4 months. And then he transferred away and had a rough time for the rest of his mission, but I think, and he got transferred to Okinawa too. They had this merger of missionaries, and then they sent a few to Okinawa, I remember now, and he went down to Okinawa, and he didn't do very well down there. And I remember getting letters from him to that effect, and then he went home quite a bit earlier than I did, and I kind of just lost contact with him. I don't know what happened to him. But so, you know, after that, kind of my mission turned a little more normal. Didn't have any companions who are doing that type of stuff anymore. And so everything kind of went pretty good, I think. I don't recall too much drama happening. I had a few companions that I didn't get along with, a few that I did. Fast forward to about a year, about 5 months, 5 or 6 months left on my mission, I guess. Not much happened in the interim, I think. And I got transferred to an area, and this is really kind of where all the pieces started coming together for me, and I became disaffected, and I left the the church, or as best I could, I left the church, I guess I should say. So I get transferred around Japan. I was fairly popular as a missionary. I had a lot of good friends, I think. A lot of people cared for me. I was one of the missionaries that people wanted to be companions with because the members really liked me. And so I always had dinners, right? I always had, people would always invite me to dinner, that always invite me to restaurants so we could, members, non-members, whatever, you know, would get all these, which was really nice, because you don't have any money, right? You're really poor. And especially in Japan, you got even less money, super poor, and everything's really expensive. So I had a lot of people that I knew and that I was fond of and that I think were very fond of me and took very good care of me. Remember there was one time, we went out to a place called Kinkakuji, which is this gold, you've seen it in postcards or whatever, it's a gold leaf temple that's in the middle of a lake. And we went to this temple grounds, and I had this camera, a little, you know, film, quick shot camera that I bought in the U.S. to take pictures, made in Japan, whatever. So I'm out, we're taking these pictures, and it's a great little tour, and we're out with friends, and I can't even remember everybody that was there. There's probably 10 or 12 of us out on this tour, a couple missionaries, and then a couple of these friends. And, you know, we're just having a good time taking pictures. And I snap a picture, and my camera basically disintegrates in my hand. It just all falls apart. It was like a cartoon almost, you know, and I'm left holding pieces and bits of camera with spools of film hanging out of them. I was like, oh, that kind of sucks. So I throw it in the trash and didn't really think much of it. And we get back to our apartment that night, and there was like four or five packages on the doorstep. And I'm like, what? And pick them up, and there's cards, you know, to Elder Wynn, we love you, to Elder Wynn, you're great, whatever. And it was from these members and non-members who were out with them. They'd gone and bought me cameras.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Brand new cameras. Yeah, it was really thoughtful. And I didn't know, they didn't put their names on them. They just, you know, this is to you. It was completely honest. I had no idea who, never got any indication who did it, but there's like four or five cameras. Really nice ones, like, you know, $200 cameras. And so I was like, holy cow. And I gave one to my companion, I think. And I kept one for myself. And then a couple others, I think I just gave those to other missionaries, or maybe I took them back and returned them for money so that I could have some money. Can't recall exactly what I did with that. But you know, that's the stuff that would go on. And so I had a lot of these relationships that I really kind of cared about, over the couple years I was there. And when I'd move areas, you know, I'd keep in touch with the people from the other areas. I'd spend a lot of money on phone cards to make calls back and to talk to people, and would meet up every now and then on P day and hang out. I had all these relationships. So I get transferred this one time to a place called Sasayama. And it was a new area. As I understand it, I was maybe the third missionary who was there. I think the two missionaries just before me had opened the apartment near this branch and started the area. And then one of those missionaries transferred out, and I replaced him. It was interesting because this new area, basically they cut a section out of a couple other areas, I think. And one of the other areas that got cut out was this area called Miki. And I had served in Miki as well. And what would do as missionaries is would start what I like to do. I didn't like to go housing or streeting, you know, I didn't like door knocking. I didn't like, you know, cold calling people. So we'd approach it from a service aspect. Oh, you know what? I forgot the best part. I kind of jumped ahead, actually. You know, I told you that nothing happened between my time at Toyoka and this, and that's kind of true, but something happened in Toyoka. So,
okay.
If it's okay, can I jump back to that? And this is kind of a big one.
Absolutely.
Because it's going to make a little more sense as we get farther into this, I think. I kind of jumped over. So I don't know if you know what happened in Japan in, I think it was February of 2000, or of 1995.
No.
That was the year, and that was the time of the Kobe earthquake.
Okay.
that killed 4,500 people or so in Japan. It was a big earthquake, and I was there in Toyoka when that happened, and we felt it, and we actually went down to the various areas to kind of help out and offer whatever service we could, which wasn't a lot. But so the earthquake happened, and the epicenter was right near the mission home there in Kobe. So what had happened was there was the earthquake, and the mission home opened up the neighboring ward house, the cultural hall of the neighboring ward house, to use as a morgue, as a temporary morgue, to where people who had dead relatives or dead family members could bring them as they were awaiting cremation and burial from the neighboring area. And so during that time, and it was pretty amazing how quickly they did it, they printed up kind of these specific pamphlets, I guess, as I understand it, that the missionaries would take, and as people were watching their dead relatives, you know, then I guess the culture is that somebody has to stay with the body until the cremation. They can't allow the body to be left alone. And so there's always these bodies in the cultural hall, and there's always one or two family members nearby maintaining watch over the bodies. And so the missionaries would take these pamphlets and go and proselytize to the families of the victims, to the people who are watching, and, you know, teaching them the plan of salvation. And, you know, it's okay, your family member's there, and if you join our church, then you can.
Oh, it's like ambulance chasing in the worst way.
Exactly. Ugh. That was awful to hear that. That did not sit well with me, for sure.
Did you do that yourself?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I didn't have to. We were in different areas. We didn't have to do that. Thankfully, I wouldn't have done that, I think. But at conferences after that, for, you know, probably 6 months, a year, maybe even to the end of my mission, there was always someone would talk about the blessing of the earthquake, how great it was that it had happened, because we were able to make contact with this person who lost their daughter, or this person who lost their son, and what a great blessing God gave us. And that was horrifying to me. That was really awful. That made me sick, and I didn't deal with that. That's one of the things that kind of went on the shelf for me. And so fast forwarding back to Sasayama and opening this new area. The new area overlaps this old area that I used to work at. And we set up English class. So one of the things I like to do, and a lot of missionaries like to do, but this was probably one of my favorite things. And if I could have done it, I would have taught English class every day. You know, I've totally been an English teacher, not been a missionary. And if somebody wanted to join the church, great, but I would teach them English and enjoy the learning and that with these people. So we set up this English class, and it turned out that a girl who was in Miki, who came to our English classes there, was now in the bounds of this new area, and we received her record, you know, we received her investigator records, and we had all her information. And I was like, oh, great, she was fantastic. I'm gonna call her and see if she wants to start coming to this new English class and help us build it up. We'll get a big group of people here. We'll be great. We'll have a lot of fun, a lot of good times. And so I reached out to her and called her and said, hey, you know, we're opening this English class. We'd love to have you come. And she said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I'd totally come. And she did. And we started, and we had, you know, 6 or 8 people come to our English class on a regular basis over the first couple weeks. And in Miki, we had asked her if she wanted to hear the lessons, and she did. And we taught her the first and maybe the second lesson. I can't remember. Taught her the first and second lesson there in Miki, as I recall. And she was disinterested. She was like, nah, I don't want to hear anything more about this. And I was like, okay, fine. And she kept coming to English class, and we kept teaching her English, because, you know, the thing with English class was there's no commitments, right? You come to English class to learn English, and you don't have to be a member. You don't have to take any interest in the church, whatever. You just come and learn English. And that's a service that we want to give, because we're here volunteering. And it's something that we want to do. And so she started coming again, And my companion asked her, I remember one time he asked her if she wanted to hear the lessons, and she turned him down. She said, no, thank you. I don't want to hear the lessons. And so that went on, you know, probably for a few weeks, as I recall. I think I was only in that area for maybe 2 months. And so I think, yeah. And then one day my companion tells me, says, hey, we're going on splits with the missionaries in Miki. And I was like, oh, sweet. Love to go back to Miki, go on splits and hang out. And so we did. And interesting little circle around here. So my companion was Japanese, and he split with the Miki companion who was Japanese, the Miki elder who was Japanese. And I went for the day with the American elder. And so we had a pretty good day that day. I can't remember what we did, but we kind of hung out. I'm sure we visited people, probably ate at good restaurants that we liked in the area, whatever. Who knows what we did. But the day went by really fast, and it was a fun day, I remember. So we get back to the apartment, and let's see, my chronology might be a little off on this, but I recall my companion said, I asked him how his day went, and this is one of the companions that I never really got along with. He was a Japanese guy, and I didn't really care for him. Didn't have the personality that meshed with mine, and so we didn't have a great communication line between us. So I said, so how did your split go? What did you do? And he said, oh, we taught the discussions. I said, what? What do you mean you taught the discussions? It's unheard of in Japan. You don't teach the discussions. You teach a discussion, or you teach a quarter of a discussion, right? You don't teach the discussion. And he said, no, we taught it to this girl who had started coming to my English class. And so I said, wow, I thought she wasn't interested. And she said, oh yeah, she turns out she's interested. And I said, oh, well, that's great. That's fantastic. And he said, yeah, and she's getting baptized on Monday. What? I mean, she's getting baptized on Monday. Yeah, she's committed to get baptized on Monday. I said, wow, that's amazing. So this was, I believe, a Saturday or Friday that this happened. And so I said, so she's coming to church tomorrow? He said, yeah, she'll be coming to church tomorrow. I said, oh, wow, that's fantastic. Way outside of the normal process for baptizing somebody in Japan. Typically, they have to attend church for a number of weeks. They have to, you know, because Mormonism is so alien to their indigenous belief systems that they just don't get it. You know, it's too much. But I was a little shocked by this. So Sunday comes, and she doesn't show up to church. So, uh-oh, not to church. What is this going to mean for the baptism type of thing? And apparently nothing, because Monday came, and they had staged this baptism. Even though her branch would be Sasayama, she was getting baptized in Miki. So we go to where the baptism was to take place, into the church house. And she's all there ready to get baptized. And they go through with the baptism. And the weirdest thing after that is everybody who was there, and I recall not recognizing anybody who was at her baptism except for her. I didn't recognize any of the ward members, or, you know, I knew the missionaries and her, but I didn't really know anybody else there, as I recall. But they had a bunch of presents, and they had this weird, almost Christmas morning present opening ceremony in the sacrament meeting in the chapel. And I thought that was so bizarre. And so here she gets baptized. They do a little song and dance testimony type thing. And then she starts opening these presents. It's almost, you know, almost surreal. And then it ended, and we all kind of went our separate ways. And I thought that was very odd. The following, or that Wednesday then, which is the day that we were to be in her area, in her little township, that was a short train ride from our local train station, was the day we were supposed to go start the fellowshipping. So we were in the area, and I said, okay, well, let's go visit this girl. And it's like, oh, my companion said, okay, yeah, we'll go visit her. And he knew the address. I didn't really know the address. I wasn't familiar with the area. And he said, yeah, we'll go. But we got sidetracked. He sidetracked us and said, well, let's stop here and get us something to eat. You know, let's eat some sushi. This sushi restaurant's really good. So we stop and we eat, and we end up kind of lollygagging through the afternoon there, and we run out of time and get back on the train and head back. That Sunday, then she actually did show up for church. Or no, she didn't show up for church. She didn't show up for sacrament meeting. And I asked my companion, I said, you know, what's going on? He I guess was interacting with the branch president, and they were having a special afternoon sacrament meeting specifically for this girl because she couldn't make it because she had to work in the morning at her parents' konomiyaki restaurant. So her parents owned a little restaurant in the town, and she was working there for her parents. I think she was 19 years old at the time. She might have been 20. And so she was going to show up later, and we were going to have a sacrament meeting with her. And so she did. She showed up, and there was myself, my companion, and I think the branch president and his two counselors were there. So I think that's who was in attendance. And they go through the kind of sacrament meeting process that he says, welcome, you know, we're going to do the sacrament now, blesses and breaks the bread and the water and passes the bread around. And all the branch president and the counselors and my companion all take the sacrament again. So that was the second time they took it, which I always thought was, you're only supposed to take it once. You know, that was a respectful thing to do. And I passed up on the sacrament on that, and I handed it to her. She was sitting next to me, and she said, so do I eat this? And I said, yeah. Do you know what this is? And she said, no. And I said, oh. And after she ate the bread and drank water, I said, well, maybe we need to sit down and explain this to you so you know what this is. The branch president piped up and said, no, it's okay. And he was almost scared when he said this. It was a bit more urgent the way he said it than I had expected. He said, no, it's okay. Let's just do introductions so she knows who we all are. And so, okay, whatever. I don't, you know, I kind of a little set back, a little confused by this, but I didn't really argue it. And so he did, and she knew, of course, who we were, missionaries, but she didn't know the branch president and his counselors. They do the introductions, and then she has to leave, and she leaves, never really understanding what sacrament is, right? Which is kind of the big deal in Mormonism, right? That's our communion with Jesus, and that's our way to remember the atonement. And here it was glossed over and pushed aside for some reason that I didn't understand.
Is the sacrament normally taught in the missionary discussions?
Absolutely. In fact, it was a big part of the missionary discussions. And in Japan, because of the distance between Christianity and Mormonism and the Japanese national beliefs, you know, you tell a Japanese person about Jesus and they'll have no idea who you're talking about. You talk about the atonement, but they have no idea. You know, it's completely foreign to them. It's not like in America, you know, you could pick somebody who grew up atheist and they know about the Bible. They know about Jesus. They've heard about the atonement, right? They have this kind of foundation to where the beliefs are at least understood, if not agreed with. That's not the case in Japan by any means. And so, to give you an example, I actually had two what I would consider legitimate baptisms on my mission. And they were, it was a couple, a husband and his wife. And I transferred into the area like the week after my companion at that area had made contact with his people. And so he and I had to teach the entire 8 discussions, I believe is how many there were, to this couple. And it took us probably about 6 months, I think, four to six months. I think, to teach these discussions. It's not a fast process, you know. It's meeting and where a discussion is maybe 10 pages or 15 pages in a booklet, it might take 3 weeks to get through that because there's just no common ground. There's so much explanation. There's so much that they have to understand. And so before getting baptized, you know, they have to attend church a few times. I think it was 2 or 3 times. They have to, you know, they have to be, that has to happen, supposedly, or that was kind of the understanding I had, just to make sure that when they do get baptized, they stick around. Mm-hmm. And then after they get baptized, you have to fellowship them. You go and you visit them and you make sure their any concerns they have are taken care of and blah, blah, blah. That's not at all what was happening here. She was taught
all 8 discussions in one day. I know that for a fact because I taught her the first discussion, or half of the first discussion of that. Oh, and but they burned through all 8 discussions in one afternoon, which is unprecedented. Let's see. So anyway, getting back, we lollygagged that day, and we ended up running out of time and having to get back. And so we got back. The following Wednesday, same thing happened. We went out there, and he kind of distracted me, and I, which is easy enough to do, as evidenced by this interview. You know, I got distracted, and we were almost ready to call it a day, having not even found her restaurant or where she lived. And we were at a red light, stopped, and she just happened to pull up to this red light, rolled down the window in her car, and called out to us, "Hey, how are you?" And I ran over to her car and said, "Hey, we're trying to find your restaurant. We want to come and see and make sure you're okay." And she said, "Oh yeah, come, it's just right up the street, just a block away. I'll meet you there." And so she drives up, and I see she pulls into the little parking lot that was in kind of a little mini mall type place, and there was their Konomiyaki restaurants. We go walk over there, and I almost had to drag my companion to go. You know, he was really dragging his feet. "No, we need, don't want to go. We're kind of out of time." I'm like, "No, we need to do this. This is kind of what we do, right? We need to make sure she's okay. She didn't come to church. You know, her eternal salvation is at stake. We don't want to, you know, put her in this position and then hang her out to dry." You know, I was quite concerned about that. And so as we get across the parking lot, we're approaching the door, and I remember my companion grabbed me on the arm and said, "Okay, look, Elder Wynn, we'll go visit her, but you have to take off your name tag." "What?" He said, you know, bear in mind, I was okay taking off my name tag. I did it quite often. I was very good at it. I could, you know, I had the little clamshell ones that go over your front pocket, and I could just, in one easy stroke, I'd have it off and in my front pocket and out of the way if I were doing such things as going to play video games at the local arcade or going to, you know, sing karaoke at a karaoke club or whatever. You know, I was fine doing that. I wasn't, you know, I'm not some pious missionary. I don't want to give the wrong impression of that. But in this case, where I was actually presenting myself as a missionary and where I was doing the work, I had a pretty big problem with it. And so he said, "You have to take off your name tag." I said, "What? Why? Why do I need to take off my name tag?" And he said, "Her family is extremely anti-Mormon. If they find out we're the missionaries, they'll kick us out, and it'll cause all kinds of trouble." He said, "The mission president told me that if we were to visit these people, we had to take off our name tags, and we had to tell her parents that we were just English teaching volunteers." And I said, "Oh, you know, the mission president said that. Well, you know," and then I'm kind of scared, right? What are these people going to do to us if they find out? You know, now I'm part of this lie, right? Now I'm, you know, and I'm scared because I need to lie to these people, because if they find out, who knows what will happen, right? So off my name tag comes, and we go in, and it was very uncomfortable for me, you know, talking to her, trying to get why she wasn't at church, when not being able to ask her why she wasn't at church type of thing. And so she's in making konomiyaki, which, in case anybody doesn't know, is a Japanese cabbage pancake type of thing. It's one of my favorite Japanese foods, actually. It sounds bad, but it's really good. If anybody gets a chance to have some, you should definitely try it. And so she's in making cabbage for their restaurant to make this konomiyaki, and happy to see us. She introduces us to her parents. This is Lance and Elder Wynn and Elder, I won't use anybody else's name, I guess.
But she didn't introduce you as Elder, did she?
Not as missionaries. She didn't introduce us as missionaries, and I'll find out later why, I think. But she was just happy to see us. You know, we're her friends. We teach her English, and she tells her mom that, right? And which only reinforced my belief that, oh yeah, her parents shouldn't know that she's a member. Later on, I think I find that she didn't know she was a member, I believe. I don't think she really knew she was a member. Maybe she did. I don't think she knew what that entailed. But we talked to her. Her mom was incredibly nice, probably just a super nice lady. And we left there. She gave us like a 5-pound bag of konomiyaki mix. She gave us some of their homemade konomiyaki sauce for free. She fed us that night. When she found out we were volunteers, she gave us free food and sent us home with this care package because, you know, we're volunteers and she wanted to help. It's just a super, super nice lady. And so there I've got this weird, wait a minute, the mission president saying one thing, but the reality of it is different. That's not what's happening at all. And here my companion is telling me to take off my name tag, you know, telling me to misrepresent myself as a missionary under the orders of the mission president. That doesn't sit right at all, you know, and very difficult. I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't, you know, and it was wrong and it felt wrong. And as a Mormon, you tend to internalize that stuff. You know, if something feels wrong, then it's you who has the problem, I think. And you need to get over it. You need to deal with it. So the following Sunday, we come back to church. We go to church and she doesn't show up again. And so she's missed, I think one or two Sundays since she got baptized. So we need to go back. We never made it back to see her or her family again, I think. And something else happened. I had a lot of stress towards my companion at this point and a lot of animosity towards him, and given coupled with other stresses of being on a mission, one day I kind of blew up on him and I had enough. I didn't know what to do and I just couldn't be around him. I couldn't talk to him, couldn't look at him. And I left him. I left my companion. Horror of horrors. And I got on my bike and I rode, and I just rode up into the mountains. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't even really think that far ahead. I just left. And it started getting dark, I remember, and I was way out in the middle of nowhere, and it was getting dark. And it was in the summertime, so I don't think it really mattered. I think this must have been June, probably June or so. So it was warm. There was no danger of freezing or anything. I could have stayed out there all night. But I kind of cooled down and, you know, my level head kind of, and my rational side kicked in. I was like, okay, well, I need to just go back to the apartment and get a good night's rest and deal with this later kind of thing. So I rode back and it got pretty dark. It was probably 9 or 10 o'clock at night, I would expect, as I was approaching the apartment. I could see the apartment was probably a half mile away. It was a rural area, so that there were rice paddies and all, and the apartment was kind of standing out there. And a car pulls up behind me. The headlights pull up behind me. It's a narrow Japanese road. The Japanese roads aren't super wide, and so I pull off into the little shoulder there, and the car pulls off behind me and stays behind me. And so I was like, okay, whatever. And so I start driving again. And the car pulls up behind me and starts following me again, and my temper starts rising, and I'm getting pretty upset at this point, and don't know who this is or what they're trying to pull on me or whatever. So I pull over again, and the car pulls over behind me, and at that point I get off my bike, I throw my bike down, and I'm ready to beat the crap out of whoever it is in the car, because, you know, I'm 20 years old, right? That's guess what you do. Stripling warrior type of thing, whatever. Turns out it was the mission president. It was the mission president and his two APs were in the car at 10 o'clock at night, in an area that's probably 2 hours away from the mission home by car. And I have no idea why they would be there. So they follow me back to the apartment. I get on my bike. I fall back to the apartment and think, oh my God, what's going on here? What's happening? And one of the APs was Japanese, one was American, and I knew the American, I knew both of them. I really liked the American guy. I thought he was great. So we get to the apartment, and the mission president takes my companion and the other AP and goes into one room, and then the American AP and myself go into this other room, and the American AP confronts me, and, you know, with the, Why did you leave your companion? Query, you know, what's going on here? That's pretty bad. And so I told him, I told him what I just told you, basically, you know, this is going on. It makes no sense. It feels wrong. And my companion's telling me that the mission president is telling him to tell this lie and to perpetuate this lie. And he said, yeah, He is. The mission president is doing that. But it's for a good reason. What's the good reason? And so what happened was the Japanese missionary in Miki was about to go home. I think he only had a month or so left on his mission, and he'd gone through his whole mission without having a baptism, which is a failed mission. And this mission president, who, let me be clear, was not President Wilson. They switched out. This new mission president was a Japanese guy named President Matsushita. And he was, obviously, as a mission president, he was fairly high up in the church. He was a translator for the church for Japanese. I think he was one of the ones that worked on the translation of the new Book of Mormon that they released in Japan while I was on my mission. So a pretty high up guy. And so he said, President Matsushita is really concerned about missionaries going home being unsuccessful as missionaries, especially Japanese missionaries, because there's a stigma attached to that. So what he's been doing is he's been personally reviewing investigators from various areas who have been to English class, and he'll make a personal call to the investigator, introduce himself as the mission president, and tell them that because they have been going to English class and taking advantage of English class, it would be very good if they went through this process and got baptized, essentially. And in Japan, where they have this very strict hierarchy, if somebody were to call you, especially if you're a young girl, 19, 20-year-old young girl, and pull that on you, it would carry a lot of weight. I'm a president, right? I am a president, and you need to do this. You know, just de facto would carry a lot of weight, and it would be very easy to coerce people like that, which is exactly what he was doing. And right there, when I heard this AAP talking about that, that's when I decided I didn't want to be a part of this. That's the moment, I think, that I decided I'm no longer a member of this organization. Maybe not a member of this organization. I'm no longer a missionary, and I don't want to participate anymore. And a week or so later, I got transferred. You know, I kind of shut down. I don't really remember all that went on during that, the next couple weeks, but I got transferred out at the next transfer, and I got transferred to the mission home with a companion who recently broke his arm and had to get transferred to the mission home to heal because he couldn't do missionary work. So, you know, the writing was kind of on the wall there. I was kind of done. And before I transferred out of Sasayama, this girl and her mom found out that I was transferring out and showed up with another care package, and she bought me some t-shirts and some clothes and a lot of food to take with me to my next area so that I would, so I'd be taken care of so I wouldn't have any hardship. And that was, you know, having them show up was really hard, you know, cause I didn't say anything to them. I accepted their gift. Thank you. And, you know, I still, even though I checked out, I still perpetuated the lie, right? I still didn't come clean with them. That was really a hard thing for me. So fast forward into the mission home. The mission president calls me in for an interview, you know, right after I get there. And this, the memories of this are very clear in my mind. As far as I know, I kind of remember exactly that, you know, and even now I'm kind of getting choked up remembering it. It was a hard thing. So I go into the mission president's office and sit down. And I think word had spread that I had checked out. You know, I told some people that I was done, and I told them what was going on, some of the other missionaries. I don't know how they took it, not as hard as I took it. So he said, the first thing he said to me was, "So, Elder Wynn, I understand you don't want to be a missionary anymore." I said, "Yeah, don't want to be a missionary anymore." And he said, "Well," and he was speaking in English at this time, he spoke pretty good English. He said, "Well, we can't have that, can we? So I'm going to send you home." And he takes out a piece of paper and he starts filling out this form. And I was, you know, and I was done. It's like, okay. So and then I pictured, you know, everything on the mission is so far beyond what you're capable of, right? I as a 19-year-old, there was no way I could go home, right? I had to be sent home. There was no way I could even call home. I had to be authorized to call home. You know, so up until this, I never even considered calling my parents, never even considered reaching out to anybody for anything. You know, as everything was internalized, which is a huge problem. And that's horrible the way the church treats missionaries like that, where they force you to be separated and you're always alone. Even though you're with somebody 24/7, you're always alone, and the structure of it makes it that way. So he took the paper out and he started filling it out. And there was one part on there that said, why is this missionary being sent home? And he looked at me and said, what do you want me to, and he looked at me and said, so it wants me to fill in why is this missionary sent home? And he looked at me with this smugness, and it was just stomach churning, and I absolutely hated that man right there. And even still, I see his face, and I, as an adult 18 years later, you know, I still hate that man. This is a visceral hate that I have for this guy. And I shouldn't probably. I think he was a victim just as much as anybody. But he said, why are we sending you home? And looking at his smugness in his face, and he had kind of a smile on, as if, you know, it's, you're doing, Lance, you're the idiot who's taking this on. So what do you want me to say? You know, dig your own grave type of thing. And that's when the switch kind of switched. And I went from being kind of a, you know, in a flight mode to in more of a fight mode and aggressive mode. And I decided, you know, I'm not going to let you send me home, you son of a bitch. And I said, and I started speaking to him in Japanese. I don't know if he knew. He might have thought I couldn't speak Japanese or whatever. I don't know. But I started speaking. I said, basically, could you turn me into a goddamn liar? I said, you know I'm not the best missionary. I know I'm not perfect, but I never lied to anybody really about the church. I'm not a liar. I don't do that. And here you've turned me into a liar. And then I went in, and I don't think he knew how much I knew of what he was doing, but I went in and I laid out everything that I knew that he had done, or that I thought I knew that he had done. And his face, his demeanor immediately changed. The smile left his face, and he slid the paper off his desk and put it in the top drawer on his right-hand side there, and closed the drawer and said, maybe we should call your parents before we make any rash decisions. I think that's what he said. And I was shocked by that, because you don't call your parents, right? In order for a missionary in Japan at the time to call his parents, I'd have to go buy a $30 phone card. I'd have to, you know, I couldn't make a call from my apartment, as I recall. I'd have to go down to a payphone and call them, and then I could either have them call my apartment phone, or it was an incredible hassle to make any kind of communications out of the country. And so in a second, he had my dad on the phone, and he told my dad, he said, your son is here in my office, and he's having some issues, and he wants to talk to you. And so he gave me the phone, and I told my dad the story. I said, here's what's going on. He said, okay. My dad said, okay, well, we've already paid for your mission, so go ahead and stick it out. You got about 4 months left, 4 or 5 months left. Go ahead and stick it out. You don't have to do any missionary work. You don't have to be a missionary. You can have a fun, interesting time in a foreign country and just learn the language, learn the people, and enjoy it. It's all paid for. We've already sent the check for the rest of your mission. I said, okay. And he said, and now I wonder if you'd let me talk to your mission president. And I said, yeah, sure. And I hand the phone back to him. I could hear yelling coming out of the receiver. And the mission president turned a few shades wider and was saying, yes, yes. And then he started saying, yes, sir, yes, sir. To this day, I don't know what my dad said to him. I don't think it was very pleasant.
Can I just say, I love your dad?
Well, I do too. He's great, but I'm going to get into this a little bit, and I don't know if we'll have time, since this is getting pretty long. So then the mission president handed the phone back to me, and I got to talk to my dad a little bit more. And, you know, I was in tears. I was choked up. It was really, really traumatic experience. And I have an older brother who's a year and 7 months older than me. We were pretty close. And I asked my dad at the end, I said, can I talk to my brother? I'd like to talk to him this year round. And, this is the worst part. This is what I think chilled up for me, I guess. And he said, no. I said, no, you can't. I don't want you damaging his testimony, is what my dad said. So all other things aside, you know, that, protecting the organization was the most important thing. Right? It was never about protecting me, I think, as I realized. You know, I was part of it. It was protecting the organization, protecting the good name of the church. So I love my dad, and he's a good man. But he's just as much a victim of this insidious thought process that Mormons have, that the organization is perfect and the members are not. And so that, you know, just reinforced my separation. You know, I am alone. You know, you're kind of on your own. And as long as you fit within the mold, or whatever that is, of the church and the organization, then you're good, and you can be a member, and you can have a family. But that can be taken away, and that will be taken away. And so when he said that, you know, when that happened, you know, as my brother may as well have been dead, right? I mean, there's no connection there, no connection with anybody. And these are scars that everybody gets at some level. I think everybody in the church who ascribes to these beliefs and these dogmatic beliefs of eternal families and of eternal progression and these values that I taught as values when I was there that I thought were good values, they're not good values. They're horrible values. Because you're deferring those connections to the organization, and the organization's a poor steward of those connections. You know, so that's pretty much, I guess, where it ended. I said, okay. And I hung up the phone, my dad, the mission president, looked at me, and I said, okay, I want to be transferred to Kyoto, and I want this guy to be my companion. And as luck would have it, I got transferred to Kyoto, and that guy was my companion, and he was a friend of mine who I knew and really liked being around and hanging out with. And, you know, I spent the next 4 months of my mission in Kyoto in a place called Fushimi, and we had a lot of fun. That's my story.
Well, when you returned home, did you continue your life in church?
A few times. And I had a few members from Japan come and visit me, and I went to church with them. My homecoming, when I bore my testimony, yeah, it's a funny thing. I did do that because I wanted a safe face. I didn't want my family to have any embarrassment. I don't know how well I did that. But in my return home speech, I stood up and I said, well, it seems like I think missionaries who go to foreign countries give their homecoming talk in the language where they served, and so I'll do mine in Japanese. And then I pretty much went through and told how I thought the church was a sham. I thought it was lies. In Japanese, I told the story of this business happening. And at the end, I guess there were two people who understood Japanese in the audience, but not very good. I think because one of the ladies came up and told me, said, I understood a little bit of what you were saying, not all of it, but I can tell I could really feel the spirit with what you were saying. So, I don't think she was feeling the right spirit.
So now do you consider yourself an ex-Mormon? Have you?
Yeah, I've resigned from the church. I live in Utah now, and I'm a software engineer, and so I've done a lot of work here locally, and the church is a pretty big employer, so I've actually even worked for the church since then. In fact, if anybody's gone to the temple recently, the new temple, and saw the endowment session, the software that controls the lighting and the media and all that, I wrote that software. So I'm not 100% divested from the organization, but...
Probably can't be living in Utah.
Luckily, you can't be, you know, but all our families here, my wife's family's here and all, but...
So do you consider that your mission is what drove you from the church?
Yeah. I think that one, and you know, a lot of people get driven. I guess you could say I was offended, and I left because I was offended, and which is true. That would definitely be true. Since then, and it's not easy to lose your faith. It's not easy to go through that process, whatever the reason. And since then, you know, which is why I'm doing this. Thanks to a lot of people who have posted their stories and have put their research out and done their due diligence to expose the lies that are Mormonism. You know, since then I was able to go through and understand a little bit more why it was happening. It didn't happen because it was a perversion on God's truth. It happened because there is no God's truth in Mormonism, right? These people weren't acting badly, really. They were just acting like a Mormon should, right? They have misplaced priorities and they're trying to justify lies and humans don't do that very well, I think. And so it leads to this type of thing happening. So once I got out and over the years, and it's taken years, I'm still dealing with it. I'm still not, I would not consider myself recovered at all. But, you know, I have a lot more rational information. I have a lot more objective information where I could say, yeah, you know, it's not true. I don't need to justify the truthfulness. I don't need to justify the teachings of the church. I don't need to rationalize the teachings of the church. Now it's become, I just need to deal with the social problems, the scarring, the actions of people. That's what you need to deal with, I think. And so maybe, you know, maybe somebody will hear this and say, okay, that's kind of my story, and maybe they'll help them, maybe they won't, I don't know, but
I'm sure it'll help them. And I hate to wrap it up because I think you have something that a lot of people can relate to, especially missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have to go, so I want to thank you for your time and being willing to share your thoughts and feelings about what you went through.
Yeah, no worries, thank you. Sorry it took so long.
So thank you, and thank you to our listeners of Mormon Expression Voices.